We're talking about new technologies to capture greenhouse gas emissions from our warming planet and whether these efforts are enough to reverse the effects of the climate crisis. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Climate scientists think that if we bring down the carbon dioxide in our atmosphere to net zero, that global warming might level off. The promise of what's called negative emissions, sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere, that is spawning a big industry with these technologies. Do you think countries, including the U.S., are capable of limiting greenhouse gas emissions that are causing climate change? Are you an optimist or pessimist on meeting climate targets? 800-642-1234 to join in. Robinson Meyer is a staff writer for The Atlantic. He writes their newsletter, The Weekly Planet, which explores how climate change is shaping every aspect of our lives. Rob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for having me.
So the last decade was the warmest one on record due to greenhouse gas emissions. Can you give us a grade? Can you give us any indication how we're doing at cutting carbon emissions?
Well, we're not doing great. I think there's kind of two things happening in climate science right now, or just in general climate change land. The first is that the impact of climate change and just the effects and speed of climate change is arriving faster than we thought it would, even a few years ago. Not only was last decade the hottest on record, but 2020 will be among the hottest years. I mean, it's going to be number one or number two of the hottest years on record. And kind of astonishingly, it's going to be one of the hottest years on record, despite not seeing a large El Nino effect, as we saw in the Pacific Ocean, as we saw in 2016, which was previously, may still be the hottest year on record. But we basically achieved 2016 level heat without seeing kind of an unusually warm Pacific Ocean. And so from just the raw temperature to the wildfires that we've seen, across the country to the stronger storms, to droughts, to the summer heat waves, to the kind of abnormal winter warmth, the climate effects are just hitting much harder and faster than we thought they would. At the same time, U.S. emissions are slightly down from the 1990s. That is due largely to the fact that coal plants have retired. But it's also due to the fact that wind and solar are cheaper now than they've ever been. And in fact, solar is among the cheapest forms of electricity in the world. So we're doing.
I won't press you for this grade. I see you struggling. That's okay. We can pass, fail. I don't know.
Incomplete.
That is exactly. Okay. That's perfect. Why is it so hard, Rob, for the world to reduce emissions of carbon and other greenhouse gases?
Yeah. Well, I mean, because carbon dioxide is how it's correlated to all the things that make the economy run.
Yeah.
For a long time, until a few years ago, basically, carbon emissions grew at the same rate as the economy. The economy grew about 2% a year, and so did carbon emissions. And that's because everything that causes economic growth, from driving to work, to flying, to producing plastics, to producing polyester, to producing petrochemicals that go into all sorts of other appliances, to industrial, to making steel, all of those big, heavy industrial uses or transportation they're all correlated to burning coal, natural gas, or oil, and to taking fossil fuels and converting them into other industrial substances. So basically, we've really struggled to cut carbon emissions because until very recently, and I mean even still today, all the things that we do that make the economy grow and that are just part of being in the economy.
And what do countries do? They work really hard to make their economies grow.
Sorry, I missed off to that question.
Well, it's certainly, you know, for a country to be doing well, its economy is doing well. Its economy is growing, which doesn't sound like it is the best situation for the environment to be in.
Well, so the good news is that because of cheap wind and solar, because wind and solar have gotten cheap and because we've made other advances on climate technology, we have gotten to the place in the past 10 years, and I'd say the UK has really gotten to this place where we are now able to grow the economy without necessarily having that be correlated to carbon dioxide pollution. But we haven't yet figured out how to do that in every sector of the economy. And it takes real concerted policy to get there. You know, your national government has to decide that it's interested in lowering carbon emissions before it becomes possible for the economy as a whole to do it, because you have to make investments in the kind of technology and infrastructure that makes it possible to use more energy without emitting more pollution.
We're going to be getting to the policy piece of it as we talk with Rob Meyer, who is a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he writes about how climate change is shaping really every aspect of our lives. We're looking here at carbon emissions, carbon capture. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Rob, explain to us the concept behind carbon capture.
Yeah, absolutely. So carbon capture refers to kind of any technology that takes carbon dioxide out of the air and then stores it in some form. There are a number of, this is something I would say is a technological process that we know how to do. We've known how to do it for a while. The issue is that it's extremely expensive. And so what companies are working on now is trying to get the price down so that it becomes actually affordable to take large amounts of carbon out of the air. The way that most of the technologies work is that they expose either smoke coming out of a smokestack or just air pulled out of the ambient air.
Mm-hmm.
They suck it into an industrial facility. They expose it to pellets made of potassium hydroxide, which is a base chemical. It's like a solid base, and it binds to CO2, so it kind of turns the CO2 into a solid. And then they run that through a series of processes that re-separate out basically the carbon from the potassium hydroxide pellet, but separate it out in a closed environment where then they're able to capture it and store it either deep under the ground or use it in another industrial application.
And so when you inject it into the ground, where does it go?
So it's a great question. I mean, it goes most probably into the rock. I mean, it goes into many of these carbon capture plants try to work above limestone deposits. Because they try to inject the CO2 specifically into limestone where it will bind to the rock and then be there for thousands of years. But sometimes they also use the CO2 and they inject it deep into oil wells, and they actually use the CO2 to take more oil out of the ground, which is why carbon capture can sometimes be controversial among some environmentalists.
Let's pause there with climate journalist Rob Meyer from The Atlantic explaining air capture technologies that could help reduce CO2 in the atmosphere. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're learning about carbon capture technologies here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So the question is, by sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere, can scientists capture emissions at a scale that would stabilize our rising seas and melting glaciers? Is carbon removal realistic, or is it an overpromise? And here at home, how confident are you in Wisconsin achieving 100% carbon-free electricity by 2050? 800-642-1234. To join in, Rob Meyer, staff writer covering our changing climate at The Atlantic, and he's our guide. Let's bring in Chris now in Port Wing. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I just wanted to alert the listeners to a great conference that's going on this week. It's starting up. It's being done by the group Drawdown. We're a group that is working on drawing the greenhouse gases down in a 100 different ways. There's a great book on it, and the conference is running all week. You can just Google Drawdown, and you'll get a chance to register. The conference is free. Register for the 2 days that happen on Thursday and Friday, and then you get a link to all sorts of research that's currently looking at the many different ways to pull the carbon out of the air. Now, carbon capture and sequestration has never really been done at scale, and it's really expensive compared to things like protecting biodiversity and planting trees. And so there's an amazing list of things going on. One thing most people don't know is that the recent CARES Act, the most recent stimulus that was passed by Congress and signed by the president, actually included a fantastic move which extends the Kyoto, Montreal Protocol against continuing to produce HCFCs. And this is a huge step towards reducing climate gases that's been done. But I really recommend people look at the Drawdown Conference for some really in-depth research on the topic, and also live interactive conference Thursday and Friday.
Well, Chris, thank you for the call. You bring a lot to the table there. Rob, are you familiar with Drawdown?
I am. It's a great organization.
What do you see here when, you know, at the scale as Chris is talking about in terms of being able to get the CO2 out of the atmosphere? Can we scale up enough to make a difference?
So I think there's like two ideas that are really important here. The first is that carbon capture is never going to be our main tool to decarbonizing the economy. It's just not ever going to be cheap enough. And frankly, we have a lot of better options on the table. It's very thermodynamically inefficient, because if you just think about how it works, you really have to touch every CO2 molecule that you take out of the air. And that takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of energy. In fact, it takes more energy to capture a molecule of CO2 than it released, than burning that CO2 released into the atmosphere. So it's very inefficient. I would say more optimistic than the listener that we can get the cost down. But it will never be our main tool to reducing emissions. What will be our main tool is renewables, is zero carbon electricity, including nuclear, geothermal. Our main tool is electric vehicles, electrifying the transportation sector. Our main tool against climate change is always going to be converting energy sources that burn fossil fuels right now to clean electricity energy sources. But there are some sectors of the economy, like aviation, where it's very challenging to see how we'll do that within the next 50 years. There's just not a great technology on the table. We may be able to get electric flight for short hop distances, like going from Wisconsin to Cleveland, but not from like going to Milwaukee to Washington, D.C. For a longer flight, it's just very challenging to see how you could get the energy density that is offered by jet fuel in any kind of renewable fuel. And for something like that, it seems like we probably will need carbon capture to pull out the CO2 from the atmosphere that is released by jet aircraft.
So why might this be a multi-trillion-dollar industry?
Well, because a lot of people will be taking flights, but also because It is possible. In fact, the UN IPCC, the kind of UN global panel of climate experts, predicts that carbon capture will be one day cheap enough that it will make economic sense to burn some fossil fuels and then immediately just remove the CO2 from the atmosphere. But basically, the combination of fossil fuels and carbon capture will be cheaper than mm-hmm. other technologies in some applications. You know, people disagree, and it's hard to know the future. What I think is true is that right now, according to the UN IPCC, we really can't hit either of our targets, the 1.5 degrees Celsius target or the 2 degrees Celsius target. You know, these two targets to limit global warming by the end of the century, 1.5C would be akin to about 6 degrees Fahrenheit of average land temperature rise. 2 is closer to 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit of temperature rise on land. It's very hard to see us hitting either of those targets without extracting some carbon from the atmosphere. We just have already emitted so much carbon pollution mm-hmm. that we have to take some out, basically, yes. in order to hit those targets. There's one more thing the listener said that I want to just touch on, which is he compared carbon capture to planting trees, which is true in the kind of general sense. You know, both planting trees and carbon capture remove carbon from the air. But if you think about the problem of global warming, the whole problem is that we've taken CO2, which is a greenhouse gas, which is stored in geological formations and stored under the ground, you know, as fossil fuels. We've extracted it, we've burned it, and we've released it into the atmosphere where now it's trapping heat. If we plant trees, by all means we should, but we start to run out of land pretty fast. I'm a big fan of trees. But if we plant trees, what happens is we've taken, you know, they do capture some carbon, but they take it and they store it in trees, right, which are above ground. And in 100 or 200 years, they release that carbon back into the atmosphere. They really don't take carbon out of the above ground system. The promise of carbon capture is that it is able to take carbon dioxide and put it back below ground and store it on geological timescales. And that's why it is potentially a more effective, it really addresses the problem of climate change head on.
It can address the now.
Few other technologies. What did you say, sorry?
It can address the now.
It can address the underlying issue of climate change, which is that there's too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Rob Meyer,
no other technology can.
Yeah, I'm going to reintroduce you here. Rob Meyer, staff writer for The Atlantic, where he writes the weekly Planet newsletter. We're looking at carbon capture and climate change with you at 800-642-1234. John is with us from Richland Center. And John, you want to bring up trees. Go ahead.
Yes, the average tree would be 23 inches in diameter, produces 15 million BTUs. That would be three full cords. We could bring back the steam engine, because the only reason why the steam engine went extinct is because they found oil in Pennsylvania. Steam turbines are used today to generate electricity using coal, but we could replace the coal with wood. Wood is carbon neutral.
Well, I want Rob to be able to jump in here. Wood is carbon neutral. John also mentions going back to steam. What can you say there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's actually a lot of different industrial applications of wood that we haven't gotten into. You know, people talk about using corded wood as a building material, and that we'd be able to build, you know, 8 or 9-story buildings, you know, real significantly sized office buildings with wood, using kind of new industrial wood substances that we're only discovering now. And that this could be a way it seems like there'll be a lot of uses for wood in a carbon neutral economy. I'm not sure I would advocate burning wood. You know, this is actually something that Europe does for kind of weird regulatory reasons in their climate laws. And wood smoke is not a great pollutant. it actually has a lot of carcinogens in it. It's not something you want to be burning in large quantities. It is not as bad as coal. But if I had to live downwind of a natural gas plant or a wood burning plant, I'd prefer to live downwind of neither. This is not a great substance. So I don't think there is a... If we're talking about burning something to generate electricity, you know, the problem is not how we generate electricity cleanly. We know how to generate electricity without emitting carbon dioxide. It's solar, wind, nuclear, geothermal. And a number of those technologies are really, really, really cheap. You know, this is not something where we have to invent a new kind of technology to do it. As far as
we're going to have to just pause there as we spend the hour on carbon capture. What is possible with the Atlantic's Rob Meyer? What questions do you have about carbon capture and sequestration? Is net zero confusing or difficult to connect to your personal life? Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're spending the hour exploring carbon capture, how to get to net zero emissions. And that means any carbon emissions are balanced out by absorbing an equivalent amount of CO2 from the atmosphere. There isn't one clear-cut formula or technology to get us to net zero, but scientists say we need to act. We need to do something now. Are there technological advances that you're hoping can help us stop or cope with climate change? How are you trying to reduce your carbon footprint? 800-642-1234. Rob Meyer writes the weekly Planet newsletter at The Atlantic, and he stays with us as our guide. Let's bring in Courtney now in Menasha. Hi, Courtney. Hi, Courtney. Are you there?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. So, really appreciate the program, and I wanted to, I guess, thank the previous caller who brought up Project Drawdown. I'm a sustainability management grad student right now, and last semester I actually wrote a paper on that project. But anyways, one of the largest areas of opportunity I've found as a manager within a large grocery chain would be a lot of our daily processes for procuring and moving food, which we all need every day. So I guess there are a lot of vested interests within this industry, of course. As the guest mentioned, you know, ways that we've done things for a long time and continue to do. I guess I'm just wondering when he would or you would foresee a time when we move to things like electric trucks and alternative fuels. Trucking has to be one of the most largest areas of opportunity for emissions, for sure. And that's just, you know, one small piece of the grocery industry.
Yeah, getting our food to the table.
Every day.
Yeah.
Yep.
What can you say there, Rob, go ahead.
I think Courtney's exactly right. I mean, I think that's I think there is no question that electric trucking is an absolutely core part of how we'll be able to get to a net zero economy. And I think it's something that should come online, that should be available to us much faster than carbon capture. I think it's something we could potentially see it might be that your Amazon deliveries, you know, come by electric truck kind of first because it's a big company and they own a lot of their fleet, and they're very interested in seeming climate friendly. But, you know, I think within the next 10 years, certainly we'll just see more electric trucks on the road. It's hard to know when the exact tipping point would come. It would probably need some kind of policy from Congress to really accelerate that transition, but just as a kind of, especially for long haul trucking, but I think for trucks that go short distances. I mean, it's something that we'll see within the next 5 years, if not sooner. And given what happened in the Georgia elections last night, I think it's also something that we could see a Biden administration and a Democratic Congress be willing to subsidize or spend money on to try to get it here even sooner than it would be otherwise.
We'll look in a moment here at the Biden administration and what may happen there. But, you know, Courtney, working for a major grocery store, what about our food choices? What about our meat consumption? How much of an environmental issue revolves around feeding the people on our planet?
Yeah, so land is a big part of our the climate mass. Right now, land is a... just on a global scale, land, which of course includes all the land we use to grow crops and all the land we use for animals, includes all of the, it absorbs more carbon dioxide than it emits. But if you look at only the land that humans are in charge of managing, it actually is a net emitter of carbon dioxide. And agriculture in the U.S., this is a stat I shouldn't be pulling off my head, but I think it's about 10% of our overall U.S. carbon pollution.
Okay.
I'm going to give you a short answer. I'm going to give you a complicated answer. The short answer is, if you want to reduce your carbon emissions from your diet, you know, cut beef first, or at least just reduce your beef intake first. There's a lot of reasons why beef is a very carbon-intensive meat. Cows can only have about one child at a time, I think, and they're just large animals. They're very calorie-intensive to grow. And because cows, this is going to sound, there's a lot of kind of just hard biological reasons why this is the case, but because cows suckle for a very long time, on an industrial scale, you have to keep mother cows alive for longer than, say, you have to keep mother hens. And that just winds up being a huge draw on energy and emissions, which is like sounds like a very bad, kind of a very blunt way of putting it, but that's why beef is such a carbon-intensive meat. And then the next step would probably be to cut most meat, though chicken isn't as bad as many other options. But I would say on top of all of this, look, I am not a vegetarian. Many, many, many climate concerned people are vegetarians. I do try to cut, to just reduce my beef intake because...
of those implications.
Because of those implications. But, I think the way to think about climate change here is that it is really a systems level problem. It is a problem that, you know, there's so much carbon. My carbon footprint's just going to be larger because I'm an American, and there's a ton of energy systems that I'm hooked into as a consumer and as an electricity user and as a car driver that I really have no choice but to be hooked into. And the answer is not to feel bad about being hooked into those energy systems, or to try to minimize how much I'm hooked into those energy systems necessarily. It's try to get those energy systems and just infrastructure like as low carbon and zero carbon as possible.
To optimize, so, yeah.
Yeah, to change the systems that we're all involved in, rather than, you know, making people feel bad for one personal choice or another. So there are good reasons to kind of cut down your meat intake if you're looking to reduce your carbon footprint. But what I always think of is that, and I don't want to come across too aggressive here, but, you know, carbon footprint, the idea of a carbon footprint was actually invented by BP, the oil company, to try to make climate change seem like a personal issue rather than an issue that kind of had to be tackled at the economy-wide level. And I always think we should just try to focus on it as an economy-wide problem because there's just a ton of carbon emissions that are easy to handle at the economy scale and at the national or state level scale, and are very challenging to handle if you're just an individual trying to kind of operate ethically
One person at a time.
The planet. Yeah, exactly.
Rob Meyer, staff writer for The Atlantic, as we look at efforts to reduce, change our systems here and remove CO2 from the atmosphere. Taking your questions, we're going to circle back to the trees. Mark is joining us from Kimberly. Hi, Mark.
Hello. There's a false security in thinking that trees are going to be a big solution because in the Amazon and in the boreal forest, the largest forest on Earth, they're on the verge of becoming net carbon producers. The trees in the Amazon are stressed because the forest is cut up, and on the edges they dry out. And so the trees are struggling. And you see that they've flown a grid with light aircraft and CO2 sensors over the Amazon. They can pick up these areas. And in the subarctic, the biggest forest on Earth, there the problem is the melting and the permafrost and the release of methane and the absorption of all the heat by the open water in the Arctic Ocean.
Yeah.
And so we're dealing with we keep pushing right into runaway climate change where the natural system will take over and there'll be no solution.
Well, I want Rob to jump in here about the Amazon, you know, the lungs of our planet. What is going on in the Amazon?
Well, I think the caller is exactly right. And this is one reason why I think it is important for us to pursue, true technological carbon capture technology. For a while, it was the case that people made the argument we didn't need to investigate carbon capture or we didn't need to fund it. You'll still hear people make this argument because we have trees. But in fact, as the caller said, there's a lot of evidence right now that some of our biggest forest systems are becoming so stressed that they are now emitting more carbon than they absorb. I can't quite speak to the Amazon on this front, just because I don't know the literature there. But urban trees, for instance, it's really good to plant trees in cities. We know that it keeps, it reduces the urban heat island effect. It's great for just local conventional air pollution. Obviously, it makes quality of life way better. We like to live on tree-lined streets.
Yeah.
But there's pretty good evidence. And I should say, I don't know that the caller is wrong. I just haven't, I can't recall that study. But I know that there's good evidence that urban tree systems, like just, trees in the city, at this point release more carbon than they intake.
Let's pause there with The Atlantic staff writer Rob Meyer explaining what the status of CO2 is in our atmosphere, what can be done. We will be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Rob Meyer from The Atlantic, where he covers our warming planet. A recent study in the journal Scientific Reports says we need to act now to reverse the effects of climate change, removing at least 33 gigatons of greenhouse gases every year going forward. And the question is, could we pull enough carbon out of the atmosphere to help get to net zero emissions? Rob, you had mentioned there BP inventing the idea of the carbon footprint. What are oil companies doing on this front to develop carbon capture technology? Where are they at?
Yeah, so oil companies are actually very keen on carbon capture, slightly to the concern of environmentalists, I would say, because, first of all, it would let them continue their business going forward of burning oil in some respect, and also because there's a whole application for carbon capture where you actually use the captured carbon to then you pump it into the ground and you extract more oil. It's called enhanced oil recovery. Oil companies are quite interested in this for obvious reasons. And in fact, kind of the, so they've invested some money in it. I think the biggest, the oil company that's most interested would be Occidental, which is based in, there's a lot of extraction in Texas, and United Airlines just announced that it was actually investing in an Occidental carbon capture plant that will be used for enhanced oil recovery, but with an eye toward maybe increasing the amount of carbon capture that they do in this, that United does in the future.
When you look at this enhanced concept, do you, and injecting it into the ground, are they looking at it from like a fracking component to loosen up these natural resources?
Yeah, precisely. So it's basically,
okay,
you need to increase the underground pressure to get the oil out. And if you inject CO2, then it works as just a physical mechanism that increases the pressure underground and helps push the oil to the surface. I think it's still a little very hard to say. Let me put it this way. I haven't seen convincing research about whether oil drilled using this kind of enhanced oil recovery technique has a lower net carbon impact than oil drilled through standard method. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But we need to reduce the amount of oil we're pulling out of the ground. So it's not necessarily the greatest news. What it does mean is that oil companies have been willing to subsidize and invest in and research carbon capture technology, which isn't a bad thing. And I was going to say, a previous caller mentioned the recent omnibus bill that Congress passed. That bill actually had a lot of climate policy in it, a kind of shocking amount. And in addition to the HFC phase out, which is a really big deal, phasing a lot of like super pollutants that are bad for the climate, that bill, at this point, that law also included a tax provision called 45Q. And 45Q is a tax credit for companies that remove carbon from the atmosphere. It's for companies that conduct carbon capture. Now, the credit is structured in such a way where it is much cheaper to use that carbon that you capture to then drill more oil than it is to just suck carbon out of the air and store it permanently underground. I think it gives you $35 per ton if you use it for enhanced oil recovery, and $50 per ton if you just keep it out of the ground permanently. And the economics are such that you'd way rather take the $35 to extract oil from the ground. But there is federal policy that supports carbon capture, and
the beginnings of incentivizing it
as well. Yeah, exactly.
Rob Meyer with a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he writes the Weekly Planet newsletter. Let's bring Ron in now from Madison. Hi, Ron. What is on your mind about carbon capture and the climate crisis?
Thanks. Economies of scale are the overwhelming factor, the million-ton elephant in the room. It's a waste of time to think about household furnaces and motor vehicles because they're too tiny. Focus on the 1,000-megawatt coal-fired plants and the large natural gas turbine electric generating plants. And if we're lucky enough to have them like we do around Milwaukee, where you have several huge coal-fired boilers on the same section of land, and you have sedimentary rock below you, underground, that has various shale layers, which will effectively confine the carbon dioxide underground. Even with our best case, if you use 100 tons of air from our atmosphere at a coal-fired plant, you only consume about 9 to 10 tons of coal while you consume all 21 tons of oxygen. You still have 78 tons of nitrogen gas that you have to separate. The big question is using cryogenic
Okay, and Ron, we're really getting into it here, but I want Rob to be able to jump in and respond, you know, focusing, as Ron said, on the big emitters first.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the argument that economies of scale are what absolutely matter here is just spot on. And I would completely agree with that. I think, and the good part of that too, is as you, Ron was talking about taking the biggest fossil fuel plants kind of off the grid first and replacing them with clean energy. I think as you clean the grid, you know, as you make the electricity grid have a lower and lower carbon intensity, that makes it easier and easier to reduce the carbon emissions of the rest of the economy. So I'm not sure I would agree with him about electric vehicles. I think electric vehicles are a pretty important part of the mix, especially in a driving friendly country like America. You know, at this point, cars and trucks, light trucks, SUVs, the kind of cars we all drive, are responsible for about 20% of U.S. emissions, U.S. carbon emissions overall. It's just a big part of the overall mix.
And I would imagine the rise of the middle class around the world buying cars
is also a huge deal. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's millions of new car drivers coming online every year, so to speak. Now, partly, we just have to build systems so that everyone who might need to buy a car if they lived in America doesn't necessarily need to because they have access to public transit or other forms of kind of low carbon technology. But, you know, the economies of scale apply to EVs too. They apply to electric cars too. It's cheaper to buy a gas car today because automakers have been making gas cars for 100 years and they are able to apply those kinds of large consumer, you know, economies of scale to making and selling internal combustion engine cars. We just need to transition it so that they're applying those same economies to electric vehicles and so that it's as cheap to buy a gas car as it is to buy an electric vehicle.
Well,
and there's a lot of reasons to think it could soon be cheaper.
In our last 20-30 seconds together, what are you watching for out of President-elect Biden and his administration? He campaigned on a $2 trillion plan to modernize our energy system.
Yeah, well, I think the fact that the Democrats now have control of the Senate during the first 2 years of the Biden administration is absolutely enormous, and it means that those kinds of large spending packages to combat climate change, first, are the kind of things that Democrats are more interested in now than they've ever been, and with a Senate majority, they would actually be able to pass them, and they'll be able to pass them with 50 or 51 votes. They don't need the 60 votes that you need to get through full legislation over a filibuster. So I think this, the ability of the Biden administration to spend money to combat climate change and subsidize clean energy is looking very, very different today than it did 24 hours ago.
Rob, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Rob Meyer is a staff writer for The Atlantic. He writes a newsletter, The Weekly Planet, which explores how climate change is shaping every aspect of our lives. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.